So this episode is the season one finale of Museum Confidential. After a much-needed break over the summer, we'll be back in the fall with season two. And next time, it's personal. Moving forward, we plan to expand our scope, looking more broadly at other kinds of museums from across the country, and in some cases, across the globe. Thanks for listening. Have a great summer. Visit more museums. There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. When you have a podcast, certain things are unavoidable. One is the mailbag episode, and now it's our turn. We invited people to ask us anything on social media, and I've gathered a few of our previous guests to join me and podcast co-creator Scott Gregory to provide a few answers. Our murderer's row of experts includes Philbrook director Scott Stulen, chief curator Catherine Whitney, and Susan Green, who oversees special collections, archives, and research. Now, let's get to the mail. But first,
do you have time for the delivery song?
Well, if you'll sing it with me.
I'll try.
Here we go.
Is there anything you want? Is there anything you need? McFeely's delivery brings it to you here with speed. Yes, our speedy delivery is a speedy delivery. Speedy delivery. To use.
Well, thanks everybody for being here. It feels kind of like we've gotten our band back together a little bit. We've had you all on the show throughout the first season. You've each been on a separate episode, so we're excited to have you back. And we thought it would be fun to have this mailbag episode. You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and they all have one of these maybe once a year, give the listeners an opportunity to put in their two cents. And so we said, ask us anything about the museum, about museums in general, just things you want to know. So we put together this group of people who we thought would be best to
Who are our answer. Contestants tonight?
So we have Catherine Whitney. You want to say hi, Catherine?
Hello, everybody. I'm in chair number one.
Chair number one. And in seat number two, we have Susan Green.
Hello, everyone.
And last but not least, we have our director of the museum, Mr. Scott Stulen.
Hello, everybody.
Batting cleanup. Yeah.
Hello, Scott.
So I want to just jump into these questions. And the first question comes from Ethan, who asked us a question via Instagram. And Ethan says, how often do you have to deal with people touching the art?
Good question. Who wants to take that?
I think that's a Catherine question.
I'd like to say never.
Okay.
But that's not reality. And it also might have a regional differentiation depending where you live, how often people go to museums. But, you know, we ask people not to touch the art, but sometimes it's an expression of extreme enthusiasm. So we try to be nice about asking not to touch the art. Your hands have oil on them. You can take off varnish finishes, get thumbprints on there. It can just sort of degrade the work of art faster than being protected. So I don't know if I guess you'd have to ask security how often
Susan,
you have to ask.
Yeah, well,
on so many matters.
I'm like scrolled away in my office too much.
So, yeah. Susan, this would be a good one for you. So we just as an example of this. So in the main villa of the museum, there are these two very famous Great Dane sculptures by Anna Hyatt Huntington.
Yep.
They were the first two pieces that the museum ever acquired.
Correct.
In 1939.
Uh-huh.
But when you look at them, you can tell that they have been petted, I guess.
Loved
over
on,
there. And
yes.
How do you know that when you look at these?
The finish is removed. So you can see the difference between the original finish that the artist applied and this kind of brassy, bronzy finish that comes in through its nose and its head.
Uh-huh.
And there are sculptures in Europe that have been over the years, hundreds of years at least, that have been kissed or petted, and noses will be rubbed off, feet will be rubbed off. And our Great Danes, thankfully, only the finish has been rubbed off. And so there was this tradition of people, as they came to the museum, of petting the Great Danes. It became kind of a good luck
thing. Like a totem.
Wow. Yeah, a totem. And the Great Danes moved around into different galleries. Right now they're upstairs in the hallway. And it shows us why we need to be very careful about where our hands are, because that artist's finish is gone. And we can still love the art, love the Great Danes, but just not with our fingers.
Touch with your eyes.
Yes,
we like to tell the students.
Right.
Yes.
Good advice for so many things. So
maybe.
Yeah. So when dealing with issues like that, just to riff on that for a second, we have some big days at the museum. So once a month we have a free day where thousands of people are coming through the museum. And obviously a concern like this is amplified on a day like that, or when we have holiday events where there's just so many people. How do we deal with this, Scott, in terms of creating a space that feels both welcoming for people, but also protecting the work? How do you find that balance?
My goal, and I think our goal, is that security should be almost invisible as a visitor coming in. It's there when you need it, but it really is kind of in the background and only kind of steps in when you kind of need a prompting. That's there. And I think we do a good job of that actually at the museum, making people feel like they're comfortable, but they're not being followed around or somebody's kind of like preemptively kind of scolding them for something they haven't even done yet. But when then somebody does touch something, it's kind of telling them not only to please protect the art, but then telling them why. So much of it, and Susan just alluding to this, is that people don't understand why. And I will say this too, the number one offender isn't kids.
Really, adults, I was going to guess.
Adults are so much worse.
Really?
Yeah, and I think they are so much worse. Kids kind of understand, and they get the instructions when they come in.
Sure, they follow instructions. Yeah.
Adults kind of feel like the people that do it kind of feel like they own the place.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, you'd be surprised. For the most part, it isn't kids. But
yeah.
At Philbrook, we try to make an environment that we're educating, but we're also kind of protecting the art and kind of riding that balance. But our security, we try to have it be something where it's kind of like comfortably in the background.
Okay, and so with the Museum Confidential show, were there pieces where people like were encouraged to touch the art?
There definitely was. In the Little Villa segment, we had some kind of push buttons. So there's one that has the, this is the uranium glass, where you push the button and the black light comes on, you can see the glass glow. So we had a little prompt that you can push
this
it.
This is radioactive glass.
Yeah, that was great.
The X-ray session also had a little push button prompt. And then the one that's probably the most hands-on is the section where you allowed the public to help us curate a show. So there you're looking at the wall and then responding as you're writing responses and putting them onto the wall.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, the motel that Annie Doucette did is that there you're invited to actually walk through the door and come actually into the sculpture itself and be part of it.
Hang out.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of big events at the museum, and most museums also function as kind of an event space or a community gathering space. Just had Antique Roadshow at the museum with 3,500 people. So big things happen. And so the question becomes, when we're dealing with those things, is there a capacity ever that we feel uncomfortable with? And I'm going back to this because of a question that was asked by one of our Instagram followers who has no name but goes by the handle Where the Wildflowers Grow.
Ooh, wow.
Isn't that nice?
How poetic.
That's very nice. And it seems like they're based in Oklahoma/Wyoming.
Both of which have wildflowers.
Yeah, yeah.
Two beautiful states.
Yeah. Wildflowers wants to know, what is the biggest/fanciest party ever held at Philbrook? Specifically during the time, Susan, this is going to be right up your alley, during the time the Phillips lived there. Because everybody comes in, they see the dance floor. It just seems like a place that invites parties. Do we have any kind of history of big gatherings?
Well, probably. Well, at least what I know. And if anyone knows any further stories, please let me know. But from what I understand, the largest party from when the family lived there was the opening party, when they had just built the home and they invited all of their friends, business people to come in and see the home that they had just built. And so that is, from what
this
I understand,
this is 1927, so
mm-hmm.
91 years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah. And then maybe the next big party that the villa saw was in 39 when we became a museum, sort of the opening party for the community of becoming a museum. And otherwise, From what I understand, the Phillips family were more private rather than being wanting to be in the social papers all the time, in the newspaper.
And the Phillips, Mr. and Mrs. Phillips, did not attend the opening
they
party
didn't.
For the museum. Is that correct?
Mr. Phillips was doing a course. He had become an accountant, but he'd gotten about a year's worth of college. And
he had class that night?
Exactly. He had class that
really?
Night.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Dale Carnegie. He went to a Dale Carnegie school. And
that is surprising.
He was back on the East Coast. And I think also Wade and Genevieve Phillips were a little more private.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they also tried to distance themselves from the board. They did not put themselves on the board of this new institution.
Okay.
They were not the directors of this new institution, and they let the new institution do what it needed to do.
And have its party. Right.
And so Helen Jane, then Breckinridge, Helen Jane Phillips, who had married Mr. Breckinridge.
This is the daughter.
The daughter was there, and Elliot Phillips, the son, were there. Both of them young people, and they were there in honor of their parents. And then they reported right back about the beautiful party. There were artists, there were business people, socialites, everyone there to celebrate this new museum opening.
We do a lot of private tours of the museum. That's grown out of this Museum Confidential show. People love them. So one person who I'm wondering went on one of these tours, possibly. Maybe this is where this was born. This is Dylan asking from Instagram, says, what is behind the door with the word private painted on it? Now, this is in our lowest level.
You guys know this door? Okay, where is this door? The lowest level.
Who wants to take this one? Susan?
So when they turned the house into a museum, Mr. and Mrs. Phillips were very instrumental in changing the rooms around so it would be open for art and for people. There are all these little doors that if you walk by, you may not actually notice them. Obviously, Dylan noticed. You walk by these doors, and they may hold the pipes for the pipe organ. They may hold just a light closet, or they may be marked private. So the private doors on the lower level next to the mural.
This is a mural of a peyote ceremony by Woody Crumbo.
Correct.
Okay.
And it was, this door was originally to the coal room. So they had a coal burning furnace, and there was a coal chute. So a coal delivery man would dump coal down the coal chute and fill up this room and then heat the house.
Yeah.
But now that room holds part of our very important HVAC system that keeps our museum warm or cool or the right humidity for our artwork. So we're always taking care of the artwork and our visitors. But also in this big room, there's a little tiny slit and a little ladder, almost like a ladder on a ship, that you crawl up and you army crawl into this hole. And then you kind of can get up on your all fours, but you can't stand up. And under there is where you change the light bulbs in the dance floor.
It's spooky, too.
Wow, the dance floor.
Because
has
if you
bulbs.
Have a light-up dance floor, you have to be able to change the light bulbs.
Now, last time I heard somebody was in there changing
it. It's like
it.
A crawl space
yeah,
for that.
Space.
We haven't heard from the last person that crawled through there. But
the last person I heard that was in there, they found this giant skin of a snake that had been shed. So when you're at the museum next, try to find that door, the private door.
Okay.
It's locked. You can't go in it. But, you know, maybe somebody will be around that could show you in there. So this is for you, Scott. And this, it says, what are you doing? It's a serious question, though. What are you doing to diversify your donor/membership base? They say, I love that Philbrook's programming is inclusive. I'm really just curious about how that inclusivity extends to other facets of the museum.
Well, I think a simple answer for that is that all museums are doing this right now. And it's actually just a matter of survival. So you need to diversify your audience and where you're getting your revenue from. They both have to be happening. So if you went back to a lot of museums, including Philbrook 20 years ago, you might have a small group of donors that basically funded almost everything that was happening at the museum. And now that's not the case. Funding has changed. We've grown bigger. We're serving like four times as many audience members as we did 20 years ago. And in that, we need to think about different ways that we have support. So that is having high-level donors that do support us, and we're really grateful for that. But it's also building our base membership. It's finding ways we can do earned income. That's everything through tickets to movies, to people that come and eat at the restaurant, to stuff in the shop. But really valuing is, and for me, it's thinking about how do we reach more people? And that's getting more people that come in the front door, that have a good experience at the museum, come back again, and then eventually move in and saying, hey, you know, it makes sense to become a member because I really support what's happening here. And I want to see more of that happen, and I want to make sure that I can be part of it.
Right.
And for us, that is so important, that base level of getting you kind of in the door And you know, if somebody that's coming in, they're 25 years old, has a good experience, becomes a member, we hope that they can be a member of Philbrook for decades.
And is that basically because, like, we now, as everyone knows, do everything online through our phones anyway, right. So you're trying to get people to come out and actually have the experience in person?
Correct. Yeah. And I mean, the online experience is great, too. I mean, I don't want to discount that, because there's people that know of Philbrook that probably never step foot in the museum ever.
No,
but know about through social.
They love the high-res images that they see, and that's
totally
great.
But we want to have a real-world experience. I mean, I want people coming in the museum being kind of that, like, awe of seeing the artwork in real life. But I think here's the big change, is we want people coming once a month instead of once a year. And, like, in the past, it's a lot of people coming. You have your one major show in the summer. I'll come and see that. I'll see you again next year. Maybe I'll just come for festival and see the lights. I'll see you again next year. We want people coming. Come and see the lights. Come and see an exhibition that's here. Come and have dinner with your family. Come and see a film. Come to a studio Saturday and your kids can make something down in the classrooms. All of those things can happen under the umbrella that is Philbrook.
We just took part in a really big program called Culture Track. We invited all the other cultural institutions throughout the city to come to the museum and join us for this presentation, which was saying basically, where is culture going? It was this major study through a group called LaPlaca Cohen to kind of see the trends that are happening, you know, and you find out things like, this blew my mind, that millennials view liking something on social media at the same equivalency as giving a monetary donation to an organization.
Wow.
And if they share it, they view it as more valuable because they're attaching their personal brand, they're endorsing it. So it's really changing how things work.
I'm sorry to laugh at that, but
it's real. Yeah,
it's these
really
are real things.
Real.
Yeah, and one of them comes into the biggest takeaway was, you know, what do cultural institutions need to be offering? And the number one thing was fun, right? Mm-hmm. We all saw that. Mm-hmm. So in the curatorial area, how do we go about presenting something that is intellectually stimulating, it's scholarly, it's all these things, but it's also fun? And is that something, where in the process does something like that, this intangible thing called fun, get put in there? Is it a beginning thing? Is it something you try to tack on at the end? How does that work?
Well, this is Catherine. I think the field is changing because that's such a priority and that's such a need for support. It's a field called interpretation, and it's sort of a merging of education and curatorial. In that study, content, learning something new, had always been high, and having fun just usurped that.
Okay.
So what we want to do is we want to turn people on. We want the Philbrook brand, people to trust that and say, I'm going to learn something new at Philbrook. I'm going to be turned on to something really cool, and I'm going to have multiple levels of entry for my whole family, from my grandmother to my kid. And we're all going to be able to engage with this show, with this program, with this permanent collection on different levels. And I think that's what we really try to do.
So there were a ton of questions about two things, okay? Cats and ghosts.
And ghosts, okay.
All right.
So can we have one of these?
Nicole asks us via Facebook, how did the lovely cats come to live at Philbrook? Now, I don't know how long we've had cats. So we have
there
three
cats.
There
are cats at Philbrook.
Yeah, we have three cats.
Three.
Okay. They live on the grounds.
They live in garden cats. Well, they technically live in the shed, but they spend their days in the gardens. So we have Acer, who is a male. We have Perilla, who is a female. And we have Cleome, who is a female. Acer and Perilla are brother and sisters.
Okay.
They're about 9 or 10 years old now. And they've been with us pretty much that whole time.
Ooh. You'll have to call them back.
And Cleome, who's the more recent addition, came to us in a really interesting way. She was basically dumped at the museum as a kitten, and we've raised her, you know, so she came to us differently. Please don't dump more kittens at the museum.
Please,
we have
don't
three.
Bring cats, don't touch the
we
art.
We did toy with the idea of getting 75 cats for our 75th anniversary, but that was shut down by the board.
Okay.
So we're sticking with three.
Uh-huh.
But you know,
you're at your cat quota.
Definitely at the quota. But does anyone know how we came to get the cats in the first place?
So our longest-serving employee, Ralph Bindle, who was in charge of the gardens for a long time.
40 years.
Yeah. He is a lover of cats. And he had a cat who was a Philbrook cat, and the cat's name was Ralphie. And so we had one cat, Ralphie. Mm-hmm. And then Ralphie went on to the place that wonderful, beloved cats go to.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph brought two more kittens to the museum, and that was Acer and Perilla. So for at least 15, maybe 20 years, we've had cats at the museum.
And the big difference is when Ralphie, who I guess was this first cat, there was no social media.
That's true.
People didn't know about Ralphie.
Right.
So Ralphie didn't get famous.
Okay.
You know?
And they do have line items in the budget. They're very well taken care of.
Oh,
they have job descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
They
have pest control
and visitor relations.
And transportation.
And transportation.
They ride on the carts.
They get veterinary trips every year.
They get lifts up the hill.
These cats are cared for officially by the museum.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and looked after. Yeah. No dogs, though. No dogs in the future? No dogs.
No dogs.
I'm trying.
I'm sure there's a dog contingency among
staff. We do have those Great Danes, though.
Okay. So, oh, that's true. Yes. Yes.
To get back to that.
Yes.
And
you
lastly.
Always rub those.
No.
No, please
no,
don't.
Wait, no, wait. Sorry.
No,
wait,
no petting the dogs.
Please don't pet those.
Please don't pet the dogs. Please pet
the cats. But you can pet the cats. So everyone always asks, is the museum haunted? Are there ghosts there?
Right. Do you have like an official response when someone says, is this place haunted? And B, have any of you sort of encountered anything that would justifiably be called paranormal while at Philbrook?
Mm. That's a good question. The official response is...
obviously,
I think it is. And would you like to support the ghosts in the museum?
As
the director said. So I have not personally experienced anything in there. And honestly, you know, we usually get a lot of these stories. And I've worked in several other museums. And every museum I've worked with have had these stories.
Okay.
Even if it's 5 years old, there's stories.
Just,
I think any large building kind of has those things that people choose to kind of believe what they want to believe in those. And I choose to believe that Philbrook may have a presence, to it, but I haven't witnessed anything myself.
So this is Susan, and what I can say about the family, the history of the house itself, the family only lived there for 11 years, then they moved on to live long, healthy, wonderful lives.
Mm-hmm.
So the family did not die while they were in the house. We can't ever say anything about the artwork, though. I mean, the artwork has changed hands over multiple years. We have a mummy case, so you never know.
There we go.
There
you
might be something about the
case.
Artwork.
Wait, there was that weird portrait of that old woman who moved, remember, from Friday to Monday when no one was there, remember?
Right.
Just kidding.
If there's a little girl that floats.
This is how it begins. Don't
there's a little
the
girl that floating floats.
Girl. Mm-hmm. And I did see documentary evidence last summer at art camp, and some kids did this movie called Ghosties, and I saw it on digital evidence. They captured that the kids were taking pictures.
Some art students at Philbrook last summer documented a ghost of
some kind. They made a movie called Ghosties, and Mr. and Mrs. Phillips were present when the children were taking pictures.
Actually, I think he had a class.
But when the adults walked by, they disappeared.
He still has not gotten.
So
the
I think only the kids can see the ghosts.
Okay.
So, that's great.
Yeah. Wow,
it's like the sixth sense or something.
Yeah.
It's really strange.
I have a question for the group. May I?
Please.
Okay. Just I'd like to go around the horn as we conclude our first season of these podcasts and ask each of you if you have a first museum memory. Catherine Whitney, earliest museum memory.
This isn't actually a museum memory, but it's related.
Okay.
So when I was 10, my family went to Europe for about 3 weeks, and my siblings and I were moaning and complaining, can't we go to Disney World? This is so boring. We're going to go to this place with like these really old buildings and uneven streets. I was quite a bit younger than my siblings, and my mom could not get me out of the churches with the painted fresco ceilings.
Right.
And my brother was 17, and he was just wilting with boredom, and my mom could not drag me out.
Wow.
That's not at all the type of art I love now, but I think it was a...
So were you like in a medieval hill town at some little chapel
or
something?
Yeah, it was some German... I don't even know where it was. Okay. Some little German church with these beautifully painted ceilings.
Wow. Cool.
And you got hooked.
I got hooked.
Susan, what's yours?
Well, so I would ride my little blue Schwinn over to Philbrook and explore the grounds. And I still get deja vu working at Philbrook, turning around a corner. But my earliest memory is at Philbrook. And it was a huge exhibition. And it was the last weekend. And Mom wanted to make sure that we saw this exhibition. And so what I remember is being on my dad's shoulders. And he would walk around and we would look at the artwork. And there was one painting. And I guess I was just learning to read. There was a brass label on the frame, a little nameplate.
Yeah.
And the nameplate and the label on the side of the painting didn't match. And maybe this is why it's...
Wow.
Like,
and a career was established at that moment.
And I was concerned.
Oh, my goodness.
I was really concerned.
A pivotal experience.
The name didn't match. And so my mom said, Susan, you're really worried about this. I said, yes, I'm so worried. Oh. And she said, do you want to tell someone? And I said, yes, I want to tell someone. So I went up to the guard and told them that the nameplate didn't match the label. And it was kind of meant to be, I guess.
Wow, no, written in the stars.
I've experienced that same thing with Susan.
Yeah.
An editor
she comes
was
and
born.
And tells us that something's not right.
She can get fixated.
She
can get fixated.
But what about the visual?
Yeah, and it comes from a love of art. Okay, Scott Stuhlen.
This is like a personality test.
Oh, it is. It's totally like revealing far more than I thought.
So here's mine, which will be that too. So I grew up in small town Spicer, Minnesota, about 2 hours west of Minneapolis.
Okay.
And so my first museum kind of memory is fourth grade. We sold Sloppy Joe dinner tickets to be able to fund a trip to go to Minneapolis to see the museum.
Right.
Come around a corner, and there's Rembrandt's Lucretia there, which is just, like, jumped out. And I remember thinking, like, I want to do that. I wasn't so foolish to think I want to be Rembrandt, but, like, I was transfixed by it. So I wanted to get closer.
Yeah.
And see. This is all going to come full circle.
And you touched the art.
You extend a hand.
I almost touched it. So I was getting close. I wanted to see, because it almost looked like this little tear coming down her eye, and see exactly how it, just this little dab of white paint. I mean, it's Rembrandt. It's amazing how it works. And they have lasers in front of all of it. I tripped every course. So I have every guard in there about practically tackling me into the space. And I remember thinking, like, more now. At the time, it was just this combination of, like, fascination and horror. And every time I see that painting, I think of this experience. It's so vivid. But now looking back at it, it's so much about what I do is thinking about, I want to create that moment in more people's lives that I had when I saw that painting.
Right.
And I also want to change how museums work so you don't get tackled when you get too close to something.
There you go.
All right.
I think that's a good place to end this. Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for having us, guys.
Thanks,
okay. We at Museum Confidential would like to take a moment to thank all of our Season 1 sponsors, including Levels, strips of black tape on the floor, benches, frames, non-reflective glass, clip-on tags, 100% Egyptian cotton, white art-handling gloves, the dismissive comment, my kid could do that, good lighting, text panels, nearly empty donation boxes, museum gift shops, taste, and the confused response, huh? We couldn't have done it without you. Oh, and here's a little inside scoop. Nothing is confirmed, but we are currently working on a major Season 2 sponsorship with Wooden Crates. Wouldn't that be great?
As we wind down the Museum Confidential exhibition at Philbrook, from which this podcast was born, it's apparent that the exhibition, a high-wire act from the get-go, had many unmitigated successes and a few flat-out failures. And we're proud of both. When trying something new, not everything will work out as hoped. Trying to find that overlap between the dream scenario and reality is perhaps the hardest work of all. For museums to remain vital and relevant deeper into the 21st century, risk is essential. We'll leave the last word to Mr. Johnny Cash.
You build on failure. You use it as a stepping stone. Close the door on the past. You don't try to forget the mistakes. But you don't dwell on it. You don't let it have any of your energy, or any of your time, or any of your space.
I went out walking through streets paved with gold. Lifted some stones, saw the skin and bones of a city without a soul.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
Nothing but the thought of you, I went wondering.
BD Delivery to youth.